So when I say orientation and perspective, this is going to be a day of perspective where I sort of unroll the map and then take a broad brush to place our little splash of color that is this congregation right firmly in the middle of this whole big picture. On Friday, I was asked to say something at the pledge dinner. It wasn't real clear what I was supposed to say, but they were very definite that they wanted me to be brief. So I only went back to the 16th century as a starting point, and the Protestant Reformation in Eastern Europe. Seriously, that's what happened. My inner teenager came out. But the reason I did that, and it only took a minute just to put us in that context, is this evening at 6:45, we're doing a weekly class. It's a history of Unitarian and then Universalism. It's called The Long Strange Trip. And we're covering Unitarianism in Europe. Just the night before. And if you have that picture, it's the Protestant Reformation. So here's the Catholic Church, and then the shift from that power center, or trying to make it a shift, the Protestant Reformation. And this was for Poland and Hungary, Switzerland, Holland, Austria, and the country of Transylvania. And that's where we're going to pick up the story, and with a man called Francis David. But they were preaching the unity of God, God as one, and that meant the humanity of Jesus, that Jesus was not God, so it was not the Trinity. Imagine that in 1568. They also had this conviction that religious thought evolved, that it changed with our participation in it, our experience of our lives brought together, and that what was new and true would be changed. And you have to remember then that this was before the scientific revolution, this was before the Enlightenment, and religion was the picture of the way the world worked. And it was the property of the people in power, the king, the monarch, or the church. And that's what the people were told. This is the way the world works. So to change it, to say something different, was a big deal. It was actually the democracy of knowledge, of knowing, and of your own experience, your own participation in that. It was so serious that people were burned at the stake for their religious positions or put in prison for life. Francis David was one of the active people in this whole movement, and it's not a big movement. That's the other piece to remember. It's voices speaking out in the world. But what eventually happened was that John Sigismund became the first Unitarian king, and that was in Transylvania in 1571. He put out an edict for religious tolerance, that all views would be accepted. So that's 1571. Now bring that forward and put it here in Hendersonville. Just start thinking about how that interacts. Religious tolerance. But then, unfortunately, he was in a hunting accident, and in 1571, you don't survive those things as well as you might today. And he died. So you had this king, a new figure, come forward. But then Stephen, who stepped into his place, decided to change all that, or as much as he could. So what was that? Backlash to a liberal move, then there was the expected backlash. And he let Francis David stay in office because he couldn't quite get him out, but he said, you cannot do any innovation. You have to say, I will not change the thought that is in place now. So he had to say he would abide by the policy of no innovation. And he said, I won't do that. I can't do that. So what happened to him? They tried him. He was found guilty of innovation. And he was put in jail for life. And if you turn to 566 in your hymnal, just read through those. Those are statements from the 16th century and Francis David. You need not think alike to love alike. There must be knowledge and faith also. If they offer something better, I will gladly learn. Conscience will not be quieted by anything less than truth and justice. Just think how much that speaks to you today. You need not think alike to love alike. A few churches, a few voices, a country right at the intersection of the Ottoman Empire and what we call the Western world, and in the middle of the trade routes. They came together to be better together. They also needed to be together to hold that space in the world. So our next segment in this history lesson tonight is going to move and take this into England. So move on to England, and you can see where that's going. The next step is into America. And then we get to what we know as Enlightenment thought, and I'll come back to that. But first, I want to skip forward because it just came up, something that came out this week, and I was noticing it. And it's to the thought of Henry Nelson Wyman, and it's the 20th century. It's a point of this kind of thinking. He was a process theologian, and he said what? He said, God evolves in the process of us experiencing, of life, and all that's going on. And he was a professor who taught that. And he had this notion that speaks to me of creative interchange. That is, that when we are in conversation, not opposition, when we are in conversation with somebody else, seeking truth and seeking, but truth also being a new way to be in the world, he called that creative interchange, because something new can happen. Not that you change the other, but something new is created by that connection to the other. If we are open to the other, if we share our stories and convictions in discussion, we bring something new into being. So what? Evolves. God evolves. Or the notion of what it is to be in right relationship with life and love. Not that we know it and you don't. It's that we create something new in conversation. When I graduated from high school, I was one of the, you know, whatever it is, that's top in the class. I don't remember. Valedictorian. And when I wrote my speech, it was about, from Martin Buber's book, I, Thou, if you've ever read it. But it really is the notion of that interchange, being in relationship with some being. He calls that relationship I, Thou. But just knowing the name, it's I, It. So if I know the name of a blue jay, that's an I, It. But if I try to move into the space of the blue jay and being in relationship with that blue jay, that's I, Thou. And the reason I use blue jay is I actually remember using it in the speech. So I, It is me, object. Me, enemy. Me, fear. Me, money. Me, other, less than me. But me in relationship is different. Jonathan Edwards, the Puritan minister who's held to the speech, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," where sinner is like a spider dangling over the pit of hell and all of that. He also kept notebooks of every day, and he had a physics of being, that being's consent to being creates more connection in the world, I, thou, and actually increases the excellency of God. What a notion. So that's being together, better together, creative interchange, I, thou, conversation, figuring that out. You can practice it a little bit, being in relationship, connection. Then compassion is not an abstract notion, but it's a lived out connecting energy that's there all the time, keeping us from being isolated silos, but together. So halfway back, I come to the Enlightenment. I said I was going to do that, where we are both a participant and a product of that thinking. You can talk freedom, reason, tolerance, discussion, democratic thought, discovery, participation, and finding and forming the good together, thinking as an inclusive mode. And if you think about that and how connected we are with that project, it's why we feel the difficulties of the present moment so centrally. This week, columnist David Brooks put this sweep into perspective in one column, the whole Enlightenment Project. That was the title of it. The language overlaps our Unitarian Universalist project and gives us more context, perspective, orientation. And the way he started it was he's just sharing a moment of insight from a friend. And the reason I hold this up first is the opening line. It says, being around a college classroom, there's a central notion to all of this story that we're talking about. Is the sharing of knowledge, the open sharing in public education, in knowledge available to everyone, not just to select few or in a certain way. Being around a college classroom can really expand your perspective. For example, last week we were finishing off a seminar in grand strategy when one of my Yale colleagues, Charles Hill, drew a diagram on the board that put today's events in a sweeping historical perspective. And running through the center of the diagram was the long line of Enlightenment thought. The Enlightenment included thinkers like John Locke and Immanuel Kant, who argued that people should stop deferring blindly to authority for how to live. Instead, they should think things through from the ground up, respect facts, and skeptically re-examine their own assumptions and convictions. Enlightenment thinkers turned their skeptical ideas into skeptical institutions, notably the U.S. Constitution, created when? The end of the 18th century. America's founders didn't trust the people or themselves, so they built a system of rules providing checks and balances to pit interest against interest. He says the Enlightenment Project gave us a modern world, but it always had weaknesses, and he goes on to list them. And one of the weaknesses was Enlightenment governance fails from time to time. And he says at these moments, anti-Enlightenment movements gain power. And he said, and he lists those too. Collapse of the old regimes during World War I, Marxists attacked the notions of private property. Then he shows how that brought us Lenin and Stalin and Mao, and then the Nietzscheans, and then Hitler and the Nazis. Hill pointed out that the forces of the Enlightenment have always defeated the anti-Enlightenment threats. When the Cold War ended, the Enlightenment Project seemed utterly triumphant, but now we're living in the wake of another set of failures. The financial crisis, the slow collapse of the European Project, Iraq, and Hill noted that what's interesting is that anti-Enlightenment traditions are somehow back. And he goes to say Nietzschean thinking in the form of Vladimir Putin, Marxian thinking in a more aggressive China, Russian China, trying to harvest the benefits of that Enlightenment order, but wanting to break the rules any way they feel like it. Hill didn't say it, but Brooks says, I'd add racial separatists and the world's other populist ethnic nationalist movements as anti-Enlightenment thinking. So he says, today's anti-Enlightenment movements don't think truth is to be found through skeptical inquiry and debate. They think wisdom and virtue are found in the instincts of the plain people deep in the mystical core of the nation's or race's group consciousness. Today's anti-Enlightenment movements believe less in calm persuasion and evidence-based inquiry than in purity of will. They try to win debates through blunt force and silencing unacceptable speech, end quotes. Not conversation, not engaging the other. And I'm not making a statement of the right or left, I'm saying a statement of not engaging conversations. And then he says, if you call the media the enemy of the people, you're going after the system of conversation, debate, and inquiry that is the foundation for the entire Enlightenment project. When anti-Enlightenment movements arose in the past, Enlightenment heroes rose to combat them. And he gives the example of Lincoln. And then he concludes by saying, we live in a time when many people have lost faith in the Enlightenment habits and institutions. And then he wonders if there is a group of leaders who will rise up and unabashedly defend this project, or who even realize that this fundamental thing might be under attack. Dialogue, conversation, creative interchange, I-thou, not I-it, not just the label, connection, compassion, participating in the very heart of God. I would say, and I know some of you would disagree with me, but I would say that William Barber II is a leader who is arising to address the anti-Enlightenment forces. And he calls for, his message would say, we are much better together. He calls for what he says is a moral fusion of not left or right, not Democrat or Republican, but coming together for common good. And he lists the issues of public education, a living wage, voting rights, compassionate immigration reform, health care, rights of LGBTQ brothers and sisters, and it goes on and on. He's calling us to come together for that larger project. What he calls the politics of division not only separates us from each other, it separates us from ourselves. And it separates us from our higher selves. Or if you go back to Lincoln, what did he call it? The angels of our better nature. Again, we are better together, even in our own body. On Monday, I'll close with this, but on Monday, I was speaking to a group of from the congregation, and I was trying to capture the things we're doing in the world. And if I just list them, that doesn't capture the layer upon layer of our presence in this place, in our lives, around us. You make all the things that I would say happen. But what happened was, and many of you heard this, but Saturday, so just last Saturday, a week ago, I came in early to finish getting ready for the memorial service for Reverend Charles Grady. That was last Saturday. And for those of you who didn't know, Charles Grady was the minister who was here before me. He was a part-time minister before full-time minister. He invited me, he recruited me, he welcomed me, he made me feel at home in this place. But as I drove up, so I'm in the pressure of, I'm going to get ready for this memorial service. It's at 3, I've got to be ready at 2, I've got to get the sanctuary ready and the flowers ready and do all this stuff. I drive up, and as I drive up, a dozen teenagers come out of the log cabin while I'm getting my stuff together in the car, and they've got boom whackers, which are these plastic tubes that make a note, and they're banging them on the railing of the log cabin, and that means they're looking out across over at the sanctuary, and they start calling out, "Hey, Jim, hey, hey," and I think, oh, so I'm going to interact with these guys, and so I did, around messing with boom whackers and stuff, when Anna Yokote looked up, looked across, and she goes, "Look, there are solar panels on the roof of the church. How cool is that? How cool is that?" And they all chimed in, stopped what they were doing for solar panels. One of the main reasons we put solar panels, or one of the things we said, is that the youth and young adults said that is the thing that we could do that says the most, just sitting there, that we're in their corner. Solar panels. It says we're a people of hope and for hope, and we're taking hopeful action right here in this place. So there we were, standing in that space. I come across and do the memorial service for Charles, and I could take you through some of that. But what you have to remember, too, is that Charles Grady wrote the history of Frederick Henry Hedge, who was a transcendentalist, and Charles was in New England. So here's this living tradition, this space moving forward in the world. And in that service, and I shared that with you before, I felt what it means to say living tradition for the first time in my life. Of all these gatherings, I felt it inside me, not as a thought, but as a feeling, that we're a part of keeping this space, this voice, this conversation, creative interchange, alive in the world and moving forward. Sunday service, we had Meg Hoke and Amy Parrish got up and talked about what they're doing in the world, what concerns them, and then what they're doing to make a difference, to keep the voice of love alive. They say they're acting from love, not just reacting from fear and anger. They're working for good rather than just fighting wrong. And they said that several times. Again, that's what? The living tradition, right there, not just in the minister. Then there was the evening class of Unitarian Universalist History, the Voices of Religious Freedom phone call on Monday morning, which is my day off, but people outside don't know that. It was following up on a meeting of House Bill 2 with Chuck McGrady. It was also scheduling me, who you have to be on a panel with PFLAG, talking about gay homosexuality. He said, homosexuality in the Bible. And I said, Jerry, I'm not real good on the Bible. And he said, that's okay. We need your voice in this space and how you do view it. I also got a call from Friar Roberto because I'd called him to talk about sanctuary and how we get involved in that in this community. Also, working with From Conflict to Compassion on March 30th, it's how to be in conversation, how to have that creative interchange with our neighbors so that Hendersonville can feel like home again. How can we be better together? So take a moment to look around this room, and those of you who decided it would be better together and came today, it's your energy and commitment, your volunteer time that made all this and each specific moment possible. It wouldn't be here without you. And that's not ministerial blah, blah, or pledge time talk. That's truth. That's reality. That's that space, that embrace that you create by showing up. Your contribution is part of this living tradition. It's your place in history. So at the kickoff dinner, I said, give it the level that brings a smile to your face. That means if you give too much, you're not going to smile about that. That hurts. If you give too little, you're not going to smile about that either, because you'll feel it. But you know what's right for you and what goes, okay, that feels right. It's not what I tell you feels right. It's what you go, yeah, that feels right. So what we did was I offered, I said, we have a little something that we'd like to give you that just says a little bit of what we think you're worth. So we passed out these. They're 100 grand bars. They're really hard to find, but so 100 grand. And then we said, okay, when you fill out your pledge card, you get to tell us how much you think we're worth. But to take it a different, after the dinner, I asked Bill if I could share this. There were little, wonderful little things. They're all a part of this space. I had the quiet joy of riding the elevator with Bill Logan from downstairs to come up to the dance that was held up here where all the chairs were moved out. And look what I just said, ride the elevator, right? Accessible for everyone, ride the elevator. Another way to say this is what I felt at the conclusion of Reverend Charles Grady's service. At the end of the service, memorial service, I extinguished the flame to mark physical death. That would be that the person is gone from the world. But then I relight the flame and say that his spirit would not be dimmed. And his life, his voice, his effect, his interaction goes on in the world. That's what happens for us. Another way to think about this is we are very literally the keepers of the flame. Better together. Yes, we are. Thank you.